This is the Education Gadfly Show.
And so when his head gets chopped off, he just falls.
And falls down. Now I feel terrible. Wow.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming our special guest for this week, the last Jedi of education reform, Chris Stewart.
Wow, thank you.
Huh? How do you like that?
Well, you know, I was really hoping it wasn't a Nats reference, and that's arguably worse for me.
So I have not watched the trailer. Have you guys watched the trailer? I guess it came out.
I watched the trailer, yes.
Is it promising?
Sure. I have like zero reference. I am not a Star Wars person. I like the third movie originally because it had the Wookiees or the Ewoks, the little ones.
You know, my kids, we were excited to go see the movie 2 years ago when it came out. And they were liked it okay, but they're not totally into it. And I'm like, man, if they've lost my kids, 7 and 9 year old, I mean, they're in trouble. They need to win back.
My kids loved it.
Did they? All right. Mm-hmm. So you're it.
There is hope.
Yeah. All right.
There are only hope.
That
ha, Star Wars joke.
And Barney are still surviving.
There is hope for Disney.
That's right.
All right. Very good. Hey, Chris, great to have you on. You are the CEO of the Wayfinder Foundation, the founder of Citizen Education, and formerly Director of Outreach and External Affairs at Education Post. Woo! And other things, Executive Director of the African American Leadership Forum. You are a busy guy.
I have been a busy guy.
Tell us a little bit about Wayfinder.
So Wayfinder is making direct investments into urban women who want to be activists.
Uh-huh.
So we are actually literally having them be activists towards all the systems that serve them.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the welfare system, social service system, the nonprofit kind of industrial complex, and of course, education.
Yeah.
So,
excellent.
Yeah.
And I should say, the voice you hear, of course, is Alyssa
Always.
Schwenk.
Hey, Mike.
Hello, Alyssa. Thanks for being here as well. All right. Well, hey. Lots to talk about, as always, in education reform. So let's get right to it. It's time for Ed Reform Update. So, Chris, I have been writing most recently at National Review about this Education Next poll that came out back in August showing a big drop in support for charter schools, including among Republicans. Now, that part is perplexing. The other part you can explain with Mr. Trump, of course, Democrats, that they, when they find out that Trump likes charter schools, support plummets. That's not too surprising. But what's interesting is that among Republicans, you see this big decline, and it's not just a one-year blip. It goes back several years, something like 22-point decline among Republicans in support for charter schools. And what I write is, well, maybe the charter school movement, we've been so busy trying to get folks on the left to like charter schools, in the hope, among other things, that more Democrats at the state level will vote to support charter schools, that maybe we're turning off conservatives. And my question is, yikes, is there a way in this big tent movement of ours to both shore up support on the left and also shore up support on the right? But what do you think about this? And look, I say maybe we've gotten a little too social justice-y in some of our rhetoric that might be turning off conservatives. Am I nuts on that?
I don't think you're nuts on it. I just think...
I gave you a chance to tell the world that I am nuts. Come
on. I don't think that you're nuts. I think there are a couple things might be at play. One, I just wonder if there's just general fatigue around schools and education, period.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's been a long time, and this has been front of mind. It's been front burner, and you just noticed in the last presidential election, almost nothing about education.
Yeah.
So I just wonder if people just burnt out on it.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of getting people back involved, I live in a rural area, right? So I live in what would be considered like a Trump-like a part of America. And there just aren't, there's two charter schools.
Yeah.
Right? There's two. So the kind of, even the interaction with them is really small.
Yep.
But in Minnesota, we also have Friends of Education,
mm-hmm.
which I consider to be a pretty conservative authorizer mm-hmm. of schools. And they have a chain of schools, and people love them. And their schools are in the suburbs. They're in my area, in the rural area. And I think they may have one or two in the city still.
Yeah.
So I think the way to win people is really to open schools.
Yeah. Now, that's interesting. And I do write that in the piece. That's one strategy. Now, that is a long-term strategy because, in most parts of the country, that schools tend to be in urban areas, and in some places by design. I mean, Minnesota, as the first charter school state, you have a very open law that allows charters basically anywhere.
That's true.
Right?
Yeah.
In some of the states that passed laws later, including our home state of Ohio, the political compromise was, well, we'll allow charter schools, but only in places that have, quote, failing school districts.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant for the most part, urban areas. There are some rural districts where you could start charters, but nobody has because mm-hmm. they're in such isolated parts of the state. Mm-hmm. It would be hard to you know, scale and everything mm-hmm. else. But, you know, so yeah, if you want to open up charter schools in the exurbs, let's say, where there's Republican voters, that is a strategy. And that probably has helped in some places like Minnesota, like Colorado, mm-hmm. like California. But in other parts of the country, that's just going to be a hard thing to do, at least for the foreseeable future. I do wonder, though, if, you know, some of my friends on the right say, hey, you know, Republicans aren't wrong to be nervous about what they're hearing from a lot of the charter crowd, that it sounds a lot like some of the stuff that used to come out of ed schools that we would make fun of. I mean, just this, you know, some of the extreme rhetoric around, you know, again, whether it's social justice or, you know, suspending kids, you know, is always bad or whatever it may be. It's not the kind of rhetoric that got people excited about the charter school movement back in the 90s, which was about empowering parents, which was about schools that were showing that, yes, poor kids can learn. And the unions have been trying to make excuses for all these years. And by the way, they are schools that are not, by and large, unionized. Mm-hmm. And that's something that people on the right really like about that.
I mean, yes and no. I think kind of getting back to Chris's point earlier about where charters have served populations well is really critical, and where the Republican voters are now is in more rural areas. And so we're just not seeing charters work well in those areas. A lot of the models that, you know, were in Ohio, which has a lot of online charter schools, has a lot of models like that, and those could serve rural kids well, and they've been a really tough sell. In terms of whether or not the rhetoric is extreme and kind of alienating people, I think it kind of depends on where your audience is and who you're talking to, the rhetoric that is used to have the conversation around charter schools.
Yeah.
I grew up in Iowa. They're having a voucher debate now. They don't have charter schools.
Yeah.
But the rhetoric that they're using there around the voucher debate is very much about empowering parents, because the parents who most want to unlock the voucher money are Christian parents who want to send their kids to Christian schools.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Now, and for all this, I mean, tell me if you think I'm wrong, that it does feel like most of the rhetoric we've used over the last, say, decade, certainly the rhetoric that President Obama used, that Arne Duncan used, is, you know, to the left, but it hasn't succeeded in getting more Democratic votes for charter schools. Why? I mean, is that what it's about? Or is it just simply that, look, a lot of the families in charter schools are poor and minority families who themselves tend to identify as Democrats. And so it's more about being in an alliance with the parents. What is the argument for continuing to try to win the left on charter schools instead of just writing them off and saying, look, they never vote for us anyways. Forget them. Let's just shore up support on the right.
I think it's overly politicized.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I think the lens on it is just, we get so locked into the thinking around the politics of charter schools and the policy of charter schools that we forget the unique selling proposition has to sell to a wide variety of people. If we get back to the original nature of charter schools, there's no such thing as a charter school. You know, it's like having a driver's license.
Yeah.
And driver's license doesn't tell you how to drive or where you can drive or what kind of car you could drive. It just gives you the ability to be licensed to do it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what a charter is. A charter is a process.
Okay.
So we have to start developing more charter schools that have a unique selling proposition to a larger group of people.
Yeah.
Right.
That's an interesting point. But my argument would be, hey, in most places, we're not having a hard time attracting parents to charter schools. What's happening is we are having a hard time, for example, getting legislators to vote to equalize funding for charter schools. Now, in Minnesota, you guys don't have that problem as much. But in Ohio, it's still 60 cents on the dollar for charter schools. You know, you still see that in lots of places. We've had some big wins in the last year in Colorado, Florida, a few other places to finally get some access to local tax dollars and the like. But it's those. So I just feel like we're more successful as a consumer product right now than we are maybe when it comes to politics and policy. I mean, that what's holding us back is getting the votes in the state legislature or, you know, the Massachusetts example, you know, the referendum to allow charters to continue to expand and have an even playing field when it comes to money.
Sure. But your lawmakers respond to constituents.
Yes.
Constituents have needs and desires that they care about.
Yeah.
Things that they get mad and angry about, they get listened to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You come to my area, there's no good pitch right now.
Yeah.
You have Republican voters who have their kids in the traditional public school system.
Yeah.
And they're not actually, they're not great kind of targets right now for a big kind of fancy takeover of any sort.
Yeah.
The superintendent in our area holds a lot of power.
Yeah.
You know, so you are talking about breaking up something that not just people on the left actually believe in.
Yeah.
There are people on the right who actually believe that their traditional urban, or I'm sorry, rural school district is actually pretty good.
Yeah.
It's and
in some cases they are.
Well, it's also they're the Lake Wobegon effect.
In some cases they're not. Like in mine, some cases they're just not. Be real. Like mine is not.
Right. I had the lowest graduation rate in the state. Like you can't argue that my school district was good. Right. But you also have the Lake Wobegon effect when.
That's right.
Every school is bad except the one that you send your kid to, because that's a personal
Everybody's
decision.
Above average.
Yep.
Yes.
Yes. All right. No, that's helpful. All right. So,
Minnesota.
So the argument that I'm hearing from you, Chris, and look, and it makes a lot of sense, is that what we need to do fundamentally to grow the base of support for charters is to grow the charter school movement, including into some geographies that right now don't have charters.
Well, we need more people having contact with charter schools who don't right now.
Yeah.
We need more varieties of charter schools.
Yeah.
They need to be valuable.
Yeah.
To the people that we are talking about. We can't just get Republicans or people on the right to just do it kind of because of some abstract reason.
Yeah.
They have to actually know what they are.
Yeah.
They have to actually see some value in them. I don't think the original proposition for them was that we're going to help a bunch of poor kids. I think the original proposition was we can prove that getting out of the bureaucracy and off the grid can actually do a better job.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which is more of and anytime you can have a universal message that this is good for everybody, you win. You know, I will notice I saw some polling data recently, some state by state data on some of the stuff, and the state with the strongest support for charter schools was Arizona.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I mean, they have the most successful model, or they have the most successful culture
right now.
It is
widespread. There's a lot of them. They're in all areas. What's that?
There's a lot of middle class students.
Yeah, and there's a lot of middle class. Right. So that's interesting.
They see the value.
Right, so maybe that's the idea.
If you had more basis schools.
Yeah.
The schools I told you about in Minnesota are actually classical schools.
Yeah.
So it's a chain of classical schools, right?
Yeah.
Why isn't there more of that?
Right, right.
I mean, that would be a selling prop, especially with Catholic schools. Not being as prominent as they once were, there is like a market opportunity, even in urban areas,
right?
Right, like we pretend like urban. So I often say that urban areas are blue, right? So my job isn't to convince Republicans most of the time.
That's right.
My problem isn't convincing Republicans; it's convincing Democrats, who usually run most of the city government in blue cities. But don't forget that in those same cities, there are some Republicans, right?
Yeah.
There are some people that would find a classical school opportunity to be a good one.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And a niche audience. Yeah. All right. Well, good. Well, hey, this is a great conversation. We could go on and on, but the listeners are ready for what's next. So let me say thank you, Chris Stewart, again, CEO of the Wayfinder Foundation. You're still writing on education reform?
I am. Always.
At Citizen Education.
Yes,
all right.
Always.
Excellent. Hey, Chris, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.
Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
You excited about the new Star Wars movie or not?
Kind of, not really. I just saw Wonder Woman on video, and that was my big highlight of
was it good?
I know everybody's seen it already, but I had
it's
seen
very
it.
Good. It's really good.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot of girl power, but, you know.
Is it, can my kids watch it? Is it too violent? Or
no, it's not violent.
Well,
not
it's too bad. But
it's adequate amount of superhero violence.
Yeah.
They're all immortal, so.
Okay. Yeah. That does help.
That's what you can tell.
That does help.
That'll work.
No, absolutely. You know, this is how the video game people figured out how to allow little kids to play violent games is they made the games all Legos.
Oh.
So nobody ever really dies. The Lego person just falls apart.
Well, now I feel terrible. There's no blood involved, I guess.
There's no blood.
Legos die, right?
It's a Lego figurine. And so when his head gets chopped off, he just falls.
He falls down.
Now I feel terrible.
Wow, that was just genius.
Anyways, yes, loopholes, people. They will always find a way. Okay, what you got for us,
Amber? All right, we got a new study out by RAND that examines teacher support of their state standards and tests, right? Just in time. It's a nationally representative.
For whatever.
Are we always talking about this? A nationally representative sample of K-12 teachers, and though teachers from all subjects were asked about their support of standards and tests, the report focuses only on math and ELA teachers. Okay. It compares responses from teachers who were also surveyed this year and last year, so they got a little bit of trend data, and they look into how certain teacher and school characteristics may impact their support or lack thereof. Survey response, because I care about that stuff. It was 45%, which, Anyway, four key findings, actually five, I think. Nearly 90% of both ELA and math teachers support the use of state standards for instruction. 90%.
Wow.
Seems like a slightly higher percentages believe math and ELA standards provide a foundation for post-secondary preparation.
Mm-hmm.
And also support alignment of the curriculum from grade to grade. Okay,
Boom.
That's kind of cool. However, among those same teachers, what do you think?
How do you think support goes down when they ask about their statewide current, their statewide test?
Way, way down.
40%.
About a third.
Yeah.
So there was a big, huge divide there. Interestingly, though, standards enjoy wide support from teachers overall, but then they dig it down and they look at all these different subgroups. Teachers in schools with more low-income students are even more likely to support the use of state standards in both subjects.
That makes sense.
And the use of tests to measure the mastery.
Yeah.
All right. Teachers who said they were in Common Core states, because who knows what's a Common Core state is anymore. So they asked them, are you in one or are you not? Yeah. And they just use their opinion. Okay. So the ones who think they are in Common Core states.
Are you serious?
Yes,
that's how they did it?
Are less likely to support their state test in math and ELA than those who report that they're not in a Common Core state.
Did they split that up by people using it, Park or Smart Balance?
They did.
Or,
okay. And I've got a finding on that soon.
Read my mind.
Another subgroup difference is that teachers who taught higher numbers of students with IEPs were less likely to support use of tests.
Yeah. Also not a shocker.
Yeah. All right. And then they try to get in the black box of like, what's going on here and how does this support play out? And they found that those who didn't support the standards were also less likely to think that the standards had a manageable number of topics to teach in a year. So that seemed to be like their beef. Still like, There's too much to cover. Mm-hmm. Also, non-supporters felt that the state test was too difficult for their students and that the test would not provide accurate data for students with special needs, especially. Surprisingly, though, and I mentioned this a second ago, low percentages of supporters and non-supporters, like both of them, just about a quarter of them, voiced concern that the test was not aligned to their standards or that their school lacked the technological capacity to administer the state tests. So those are two big areas, right, to, that we used to gripe about that we weren't there, and now they're at least saying we don't have those concerns. Number five, final one, there were no significant changes in teachers' overall concerns about standards and tests from last year to this year, except for a couple, and here's your Park finding, including teachers in states that administered the Park ELA test in both 2015 and 2016 showed a measurable decrease in various concerns about that particular test. Specifically, they were less likely to say the test would be too difficult for their students, less likely to say they wouldn't provide accurate scores or it'll take away from other important classwork. So I think it was a good news and some not so good news. Teachers like the standards. They still don't seem to like Common Core too much. They don't like the state test too much, but alignment is better. They don't have concerns about technology like they used to. And once you get used to Park, it seems like people think it's not so bad.
So, okay, a couple of things that fascinating. Thank you, Amber. Yeah. So, first of all, it does sound like there is a huge difference between these findings for what teachers think of standards and what we found in our Education Next poll and other places. I mean, you know, in EdNext, you know, support for teachers really started going down before the general public. I think back in like
support for teachers. Oh, okay.
For the Common Core really started to move down in, I think, 2013, and then the general public followed along. It's still pretty low. It is higher if you just talk about common standards than if you talk about Common Core. But it's still nowhere near as high.
They're not asking them about Common Core, right?
They split the sample and, you know, half it's Common Core and the other half they just describe.
Okay. They use the word. It's like a messaging thing in EdNext. I gotcha.
But it's still, even when you just say, you know, do you support the use of common high standards or something like that? It's, I don't know, maybe 60%? I'd have to look that up. Certainly not 90%.
I'm just confused,
like what that difference is. Well, and we should really, if we could dig in and look at the wording and try to understand, like, why are they?
But it's the difference between saying Common Core and just saying state standards, or just in general,
Common Core, I think it's something like 60%, not 90%.
So I've been thinking a lot about something that John White said at our event last week, over the last, I guess, week. And I'm going to paraphrase and I'm going to get it wrong, but he's like, teachers like cohesion. They don't like when they're getting a bunch of mixed messages and it doesn't add up to something cohate and total and full. And teachers also, like, having been one, Amber, you've been one, like, are kind of master BS detectors. Like, they deal with, you know, the dog ate my homework, various other things all the time. And they have a pretty good, I think, sense of stuff. So I think, especially in areas where, you know, they've had these standards, but these tests that aren't aligned and this curriculum that doesn't lead to either those tests or those standards, like, that, you know, is problematic and becomes a point of frustration. But the idea of standards and having this like pathway and this goal that they're working towards with their students, I think makes sense if you're a teacher.
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to try to dig in and understand why those differences are. The other thing about this question, that they feel like the test is too hard. I mean, I think that is interesting in that, I mean, first of all, let's acknowledge they could be right. I mean, they, you know, I mean, we think, I think we, you know, would generally hold the notion that there's been a good attempt to try to link the sort of quote passing scores with college readiness, mm-hmm. and that is a high bar. And at a time when only about 40% mm-hmm. of American kids graduate college ready, it makes sense that only about 40% of most of these tests are passing, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So that looks about right to us.
Right.
But the teachers, you know, maybe that's a little too high. Maybe that some of those kids that aren't passing could go on and do okay in college. Or it could be an opportunity where we need to help teachers, you know, kind of convince them that this mm-hmm. stuff is linked. For example, if we could show them, hey, kids who score at this level in seventh grade, here's the ACT score they tend to get in 11th grade. Right. Look, it's, you know, it's only an 18.
We're not just pulling this out.
Yeah, and that's not high enough.
Yeah.
You know, you need to understand that, you know, your kids that are scoring at the 50th percentile nationally, that's mm-hmm. not good enough to be college ready mm-hmm. because, you know, you got to be at the 60th percentile nationally.
Which makes it all the more interesting that teachers in low-income schools were more supportive of both standards and tests, right? Mm-hmm. Almost like the realization that we get that our kids got a ways to go and we got to catch them up.
I also think they find them to be kind of a backstop for conversations and stuff like with parents, with administrators about how people are doing. So if you buy into the tests, you can use them in better ways.
Well, right. And it could, you know, but that's right. And mm-hmm. Maybe these teachers in more suburban areas or middle class areas, you know, they have assumed that, you know, all their kids are going to do fine. But if you look at the data, most of those places, no. I mean, there's plenty of kids coming out of middle class mm-hmm. suburban schools that end up in remedial education. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe this question is, what can we do to really educate educators to, you know, help see, mm-hmm. connect the dots here? Mm-hmm. I think there's some potential.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't disagree.
Mm.
Very cool.
Okay. Hey, cool stuff, Amber. Thank
yes,
you.
Indeed.
Hey, we have a study in the works related to this as well. So we'll get some more updated findings.
We will in not too many months. All early 20, what year are we in? 18.
We're going into 18.
and we'll be digging into really implementation. Right?
Yes.
We want to understand more and more what this looks like on the ground. All right. Thank you, Amber. Until next time.
I'm Alyssa Schwing.
And I'm Michael Trilli, the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.